Welcome to Connect the Dots podcast, presented by Nine Dots and hosted by Jeffrey Klein. We share stories and explore their power to impact others. Our aim is to share some edutainment, to give some useful nuggets that can be applied to your business while also entertaining you. Thank you for listening. Here is your host, Jeffrey.
This episode is juicy, as my guest is Joe Cross, who knows a thing or two about juicing. We chat about his journey from being fat, sick, and nearly dead to becoming a plant-based food advocate that is inspiring and impacting millions across the globe. Enjoy and juice on. I am thrilled with my guest. Joe Cross is an Australian entrepreneur, author, filmmaker, and wellness advocate. He's most known for his award-winning documentary, Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, in which he tells the story of his 60-day juice fast. He is the founder and CEO of Reboot with Joe, a health and lifestyle brand. Following the release of his documentary, Joe has published 6 books about juicing, including a New York Times bestseller, The Reboot with Joe Juice Diet, Lose Weight, Get Healthy, and Feel Amazing. The website of the organization offers guides for starting the juice fast and which fruits and vegetables to select. What I found really interesting, the organization has a medical advisory board to collect data and conduct research about the benefits of juicing. Joe travels the world sharing his passion for healthy living and has impacted countless people, including myself, who is currently in the midst of a Joe Juice Fast reboot. Welcome, Joe.
G'day, Jeffrey. Great to be on the show, mate.
Anything I missed out that you want to share with our audience?
No, look, I think that I'm very proud of all the work that my team and I have done. What you just laid out there is not just one man, that's a team. And it's been a great team effort. And it's been not only the people who have worked directly for me, but it's also the many, many hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people that have been part of the community, because they've actually, you know, someone exactly like what you're doing now, Jeffrey, which is, you know, you watch the movie. You sort of got excited about what you saw, the story that was told there fired you up, and somewhere internally it hit a nerve and a trigger that has got you not eating food for 5 days now, which is, that's pretty powerful if you think about it. So there's just many, many other people out there that are part of what we've done, and that's probably the missing link, that this is a team effort. And it all sort of is, you know, community and ground up. And I'm just very, very proud to be a part of it.
And for me as well, I'm part of that community. And I got introduced to the community from a friend of mine. So a very good friend of mine who has always been sort of into health, my friend Donnie, who lives in L.A., told me about the movie. And then he was actually doing his juice fast. And then so I went and saw the movie and then sort of all spiraled from there. And everyone thinks I'm a little crazy. I'm sure you get that a lot.
it's funny, you know, you get lots of people that don't understand or they haven't taken the time to really think it through. And the first reaction, and I understand that as a first reaction, like, not eating food, how could that be good for you? Mm-hmm. You know? Like we have this pre-juxtaposition that, you know, if you don't eat for a certain period of time, you will die. And while that statement is true, the real key to it is what's the certain period of time? Mm-hmm. And it's extrapolating that out. And interestingly enough, for each and every human on the planet, it's a different time for all of us because it all depends on our health at the beginning, mm-hmm. how much stored energy in the fat and in the muscles that we have, and so it's an interesting Pandora's box once you open it up. But for those of that have sort of, you know, to use pardon the pun, have drunk the Kool-Aid or drunk the green juice, They kind of get it. It sort of reveals itself in an incredible way to self.
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked me even 2 months ago would I consider doing this, I would have said, why would I ever think to do that? And I think even the people who aren't necessarily drinking the Kool-Aid are intrigued by it.
You know, I think there is something, because there's something about the fact that food is so part of our life every single day. And what I find, you know, I couldn't watch television without seeing a million ads, or, you know, it's just around us all the time. And I think, again, we are very conscious about certain things and behaviors we do, and often food, we know, you know, and you've talked about this in the movie, you know, people know what's good for them, but yet they're eating this horrible, you know, stuff for our body. So it's, yeah, I have drank the Kool-Aid to a certain degree, and you know, my reboot is really, people say, why are you doing this? Are you trying to lose weight? And I said, no, you know, for me, it's a, I use your term, reboot, to try and alter my relationship with food and be just be more mindful about it, you know, which I
well,
think.
There's no better way to just understand on a personal level how connected you are to something. Until you take it away. And look, let's just for a second, just forget about food for a minute. In the modern day, you take away this smartphone from people.
They go nuts.
You know, for a few hours, let alone a few days or heaven forbid a week. And you know, I mean, I'm as guilty as the next person. I go for walks and it's a real decision. Do I go for a walk by leaving my phone at home or in the hotel room? And do I just go and walk without it? Or do I take it? And it's not to check on it. It's to use it for music or use it for a podcast or to use it to stay in touch so I can walk further. I mean, there's the trade-off with all of this. But, you know, I read recently, and I don't know how they measure this, but and once I read it, I became aware of it, that, you know, we check our phones the number of times a day we actually just look at the screen just by pure habit is something like over 250 times a day. Now, when I read that, I said, that can't be right. But then because I've got that knowledge in my brain now, I'm actually checking how I subconsciously just look myself at the phone. Now, I try to make out, well, I'm checking the time, but I'm not really, it's just it's a habit. It's an extension of self. So yes, when you tell me that, you know, it's very difficult to watch television when you're on a reboot, when you're not eating food, I agree, because there is so much subliminal messaging and actionable advertising. I remember watching a series of The Sopranos about 7 or 8 years ago. I rewatched that great television show, and I was doing a reboot at the time, and I had to stop because, you know, Tony and everybody, they're having all their pasta and having
all
their,
the time.
So it's you got to choose your television shows when you're on a reboot. You got to be careful.
That's why I watched both your movies while I did that. You know, I watched Fat, Sick, and the Early Dead on day two. I was like, okay, I'll get in the mindset. I recommend that to anyone who doesn't watch the second movie while you're in the reboot. Right. Well, let's get started. So I've got 9 questions for you, based, you know, a little more on about who you are and geared towards story. Because, you know, I think on one of the websites, it describes you as a storyteller, and that's kind of my mission is to talk to people about story, both telling stories and then what they think makes stories. So we start at the beginning. So if you could tell us where you were born and what did your parents do for a living?
So I was born in Sydney, Australia. And
lovely place.
My mum and dad were both in the medical world. My dad became an orthopedic surgeon, so specializing in the area of the knee. He obviously did hips and feet early when he was younger, but his specialty as he sort of got into his field was the knee. And when I was born, he was just a young doctor at a hospital as a resident. And my mum was a nurse at the hospital, and they met in an elevator. So I'm kind of lucky that that happened, because I wouldn't be here without it.
Elevator pitch for you.
That's right.
I would like to know what the pitch was that your dad gave to your mom.
Well, I think the door was closing and the hand came in. And so that was dad. So it was just as well that he put his hand in the elevator and stuff. So these days when I'm in an elevator and I see a hand come in, I don't get upset because of, you know, it's part of my life, the beginning of it anyway. And so they met, they were very young, relatively speaking in today's terms. I think they were, and I think my mum was 20 and my dad was 22. Mm-hmm. And I was the first born. And so myself and my brothers and sister came along, my mum switched from being in the world of medicine to interior decorating and so on. So that was their career. But Dad stayed in, obviously, as a surgeon and, became a very well-known sports medicine orthopedic surgeon in Australia.
Excellent. So was there someone when you're growing up who was a great storyteller, and kind of what made them such a good storyteller?
So I think that the answer to that is yes, and that was my dad. Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know whether that's because he was my dad or whether he was just good at telling stories, but there was, what would happen is that it would be great. I can remember as a young kid, and I'm talking about young, I'm talking about like sort of, 12 and under, when my dad's friends would come over and they would then tell stories and I would listen. It wasn't like the stories were for me. Mm-hmm. It was as though I was the fly on the wall, or I'd be just in the vicinity. I sort of felt that if the stories were for me, they were going to be filtered and they were going to be constructed for my sort of age group. And I was more interested in understanding how these older people in the room communicated and how they talked. And so very often mum and dad would have dinner parties, and at the dinner parties we'd have to go to bed early, but I would stay up and listen by the door or around the corner in the hallway to what was being said and the stories. And so, yeah, my dad was a very good storyteller, and he had a best friend who was a Maris brother, actually, not a priest, but if you know anything about the Catholic religion, he was a brother. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of, I actually don't know how you would explain that if you're not in the Catholic religion, but you have like priests, you have brothers, and you have sisters. And so he was a brother, and he was the headmaster of a very well-known school in Sydney. And when he would come over, his name was Marshall McMahon. When he came over, he was a great storyteller as well. And I think that was because he was a very good teacher. Mm. And I think, my dad's a teacher. As a surgeon, you have to teach younger doctors. Marsh was a teacher at school. And I think that people who teach and the ones that are very good at teaching are very good storytellers, and they can narrate through and educate as an entertaining and fun way.
Well, it's funny because I refer to all my content that I try and put out in the world as edutainment. So I think it's important that, yes, you want to entertain. It's equally important to entertain and share something of value. So that's the education part, is that you're giving some value, but you can give value without it being entertaining, and people aren't going to pay attention. And if you're just entertaining and you're not giving value, then they're not going to pay attention. I think you need to.
Yeah, well, I always think about joke telling as a real art of storytelling, telling a joke, which is something that I'm someone who is very comfortable sitting around a campfire or a dinner party table or a group of friends at a barbecue, and just going one-on-one with someone else who just joke after joke after joke. It's not much fun when you're the only joke teller.
Right.
After two or three, you kind of get sick of your own voice. But if there's someone else who's very good at telling jokes and you go one for one for one and you share it up, that can be a lot of fun. And
I used to deal with my barber. He'd sit in the chair, and when I was cutting my hair, he would tell me a joke, and I would, knowing that he was a joke teller, I'd have to come prepared with some jokes. I have a question for you about that, though. Do you find you tell any jokes that your father told you? Because I found that I sometimes do that. I've appropriated some of my dad's jokes as my own.
Yeah, I not anymore. I think it's the other way around now. but there's certainly... Certainly, there's a few old jokes which which my dad used to tell over and over and over again to, you know, to different people that I heard, and they were sort of ingrained into my mind. And yeah, there's a few in Australia. We have Irish jokes. Mm-hmm. I guess it's a bit like Americans have Polish jokes. Is that right?
We're equally offensive to both. So
yeah, and I was going to say, and maybe today in today's world, these sorts of jokes are inappropriate now, but back then it was all done in jest and fun. And you know, there were Australian jokes done by the Kiwis or New Zealanders, and vice versa. And it was a very big theme in Australia through our UK television that we would get would be very funny shows like the Two Ronnies and the Dave Allen Show, and these were all based on the idea of telling Irish folklore jokes.
I lived in Manchester, England for 10 years, and so I heard plenty of Irish jokes being told between the people. So it still happens today. So I can't.
Watch it on YouTube for those young people that don't know what we're talking about. The Dave Allen Show has some very funny skits, and as does the Two Ronnies.
I can't go on to the next question without asking you to share a joke.
So I think that so one of the jokes that my dad used to tell was the and I can't do the Irish accent, but he used to do to the thing where the fella pulls up in St. Stephen's Green in Ireland, and he says, "Look, I want to get to the airport." And he asks this fella, he says, "Can you give me some directions to the airport?" He says, "Oh yeah, it's pretty easy." He says, "What you do? You go down this street, you take a left, then you turn right, and you get to the church." He says, "Well, hold on, no, don't go that way. I tell you what you do. Turn the car around, go down that, go over the little pont bridge. You'll see a beautiful little shop on the right-hand side, and there's a butcher, and then take a left." He says, "Oh, actually, you know what? Don't go that way either. Here's what you should do. Take the first right, the second left, and then take the right after that. And when you get over that hill, you'll see this park." And he says, "Actually, you know what? I wouldn't go that way either. To be perfectly honest, I wouldn't start from here."
Very cute.
Anyway, so that's a dead.
I like it. So going back to kind of the story in general, whether it's telling a joke or telling a story, do you think there's a particular element that's important to tell a good story?
A particular element. I think absolutely. I mean, I think that, I think that the idea of storytelling, it's very, you know, that's a very good question that I think deserves some thought. So I think timing, I think narrative skill of using the visualization and the words, to me, you've got to take people on a path. And particularly if you're talking about a joke, you are taking them on a path, and then there's a switch. There's a switch at the end where You've set up a way where you are going down a one, a two, a three. There's this chronological four, a five. And then all of a sudden, instead of getting a six, you get a 14.
Right.
And it's that shift from the six in the speed to the 14. It's that particular bait and switch, if you like, that evokes, if it's done properly, it'll evoke a laugh. Logically, things will happen. All will be revealed as to why you said the one, two, three, four, and five, as to how you got to the 14. And it's that little bit of time travel, that little bit of, and it could be backwards, or it could be in another dimension sideways. But I sort of feel that can evoke a laugh, that can evoke a response of "I didn't see that coming," or "I should have seen that," or whatever. So
I often think of movies that effectively do that. And, you know, the one that came to mind was, you know, M. Night Shyamalan, when he has those twists at the end that are unexpected, that he does very well, that really compel people to go, "Oh, I didn't see that," you know, the surprise element. And I think, you know, when you're telling a story or a joke, the punchline has to be one that shifts someone's expectations of what they were going to hear.
Yeah, so I think that, you know, they're laying out little bits and pieces, little clues, little snippets for us to be tempted to pick up and maybe use or maybe not. So I think that that's important. I also feel that in storytelling, you know, to be a good storyteller, you really need to be a good listener. It's not so much about just talking. It's very much about listening and, you know, listening and having an audience and feeling the energy in the room for the story and the eye contact and just realizing and you know, there's so many inputs to come in to telling a good story. I know sometimes when I'm giving a speech or giving a talk that I can feel the room that I'm losing them. And I will fast track that story and just move on and get it out of the way because it wasn't working. And there are other times where I'm telling a story that I know that I'm really in sync and I'll embellish it more. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fish, it wasn't 2 feet long. I thought it was 2 feet long. And so I feel that you can't be in your bubble of, I've got a mission to do. I had a plan. I was going to tell this and it was going to be this linear and then that'll work every time. Mm. So a good storyteller, I think, is incredibly adaptive and is able to feel these other signals, be they just people moving in their chair or how still they are or whether they their eyes go off you and look somewhere else in the room or check their phone is an obvious one. But you know what I'm saying. And these are all subliminal messages that a very good storyteller can pick up on and then utilize.
Agreed. So do you think it's important in the, you know, we're talking about jokes and that kind of context. Do you think it's important in the business context to be able to tell compelling stories?
Well, I think if you're an engineer in the back room of a place, it's probably not as important if you're the salesperson. Mm-hmm. You know, the human connection. I mean, let's, you know, if you talk about commerce, industry, business, you know, it all, I'm sure there are some exceptions, but the majority of business occurs at a level where there's interaction between humans, and that interaction on a personal level, whether it's a salesperson interfacing with a customer, then I think storytelling is key. If it's a brand, that brand really wants to tell a story. You know, you take some of the iconic brands in the world, you know, like Nike, just as one that comes to mind. If you think about Nike, I mean, Nike is a storyteller in itself, just that brand and what their message is. And I think at the moment, if I sort of just think Nike, I think about Just Do It. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like there's a story behind. If I buy their clothes, if I buy their runners, then I'll do it. You know, I will get off the couch and I will join the winning team. And I will go for that trail hike and I will, you know, I'll put those shorts on or those, what are they calling, yoga pants, and I'll look amazing. Now, I mean, you know, clearly I don't look good in yoga pants, but you know what I'm saying. So it's the storytelling in business, I think, is mission critical. And no matter what industry you're in, I think that story, you know, it's innate and it plays an incredible role in our lives.
Do you think that being a good storyteller is a skill that can be developed as opposed to you have to either you got it or you don't? So you're talking about, well, if you're a salesperson, maybe it's because you're a good storyteller. But do you think storytelling can be taught in terms of the skills that you need?
I'd like to think that each of us have the ability to tell a few good stories. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't know whether you can take somebody who's got 2 or 3 good stories in them and could have 400 or 500. I don't know whether that's possible, but I sort of inherently believe that in our core, there's a lot that we haven't let free or discovered. I have a saying, Jeffrey, that is, you don't learn anything new, you just remember what you've forgotten. And basically what the premise of that is that you are born with all the answers to all the biggest problems that you are going to face in your life. And your job is to get them to the surface. You've got to seek out people to help you bring those answers from the deepest inner sanctum of your mind, spirit, body, wherever you want to place them, to the consciousness. And it might be someone you just meet on a bus trip for like 10 minutes. It might be someone you meet in a dog park. It could be someone who you've known for 50 years. It could be your spouse. It could be your son or daughter or your parent. It could be someone very close or it could be someone very far, but they might just trigger something. They might just say something which then allows you to put something in a different perspective. It could be a film. Yeah. It could be all of these things, but I believe that we've got these answers within. So if you're struggling to be a storyteller, if you're struggling to improve your skills on that, I believe that we have them. But for some people, they come incredibly naturally. It's just who they are, and it's like being able to run really fast versus being able to, you know, not run fast. Like, I was never fast. I mean, in my school, out of like 100 kids, I probably was bottom 10 in terms of speed. So no matter what I did, I was never going to be able to be fast because that's just who I was. And I accept that. I had to find other things that I was good at, which was like lifting weights or, you know, rowing or playing rugby. So there are other things that my body type, my skill set could adapt to. And I think in storytelling, it can be the same way, is that some people are really clever at telling a story and holding an audience for a long period of time, and that they are not necessarily extroverted. They could be introverted, but they're just very good at putting words together and taking you on a journey where there is a relaxation and a comfort and you're very happy to hear their voice. Where there's other people that have got to realize that their storytelling skills are limited, and so they should be short and sharp and to the point, and that can create mystery in itself. Mm. And just because someone can tell a story for 1 minute versus maybe 1 hour doesn't mean the 1 minute wasn't a better story. So I think that
quality, not quantity.
Yeah. So I think the answer is yes, but I think it's there's levels to how far you can take it.
I agree. I think there are certain skills in terms of making you a better storyteller than you when you start. But whether you're going to be a master storyteller, some people may never get there.
Yeah. And you can tell stories today, not just in voice.
Right.
You can write. You can write 100%. Stories. And I think there are certain people who are better at skills at writing stories than maybe verbally telling them, and vice versa. And so we should also, I think, pay homage to, you know, this golden years of television we're witnessing right now, where with the advent of Netflix and of the Amazon and of iTunes and of now Facebook with their Facebook Watch and Hulu and the networks, HBO, Showtime, and all of these powerhouse television content creators, there is incredible storytelling going on out there in the world of digital assets, and it's very exciting. I mean, you know,
couldn't agree more. Exciting.
So, you know, those people who are behind that's collaborative storytelling. Mm-hmm. Well, that's just not an individual; that's a group of people coming together, and I think that's a skill unto itself.
It's interesting because I thought about, you know, wanting to be a writer and writing, and you look at the TV the way that TV shows are written, where it's often a group of people. You're like, oh, you know, go see the writer, and it's a team. It's a whole group of people who are, you know, especially in the sitcom space, you know, where people, I was listening about Seinfeld, which I love, and there's a whole team. You know, Larry David talks about the fact that, like, he didn't know there was a whole bunch of people who were going to be helping write the story.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's definitely, collaboration, I think, is something that can be really powerful when you're trying to tell a story. And even if it's getting feedback from people about what could be better or worse about a story, you can't work, you know, in isolation. I think sometimes people try too hard to do that.
I learned that with my film. I mean, you know, with Fat, Sick, and Nearly Dead, you know, I filmed over 500 hours of footage, and the end result is like an hour and 35 minutes. So you think about that I utilized, you know, less than 1% of all the content that I filmed is in the film. And I think if you added up the number of cuts and the number of frames, you're into the thousands of different little miniature packets of information that you've got to then draw on and pull together and then give a story, because holding people's attention is really hard. I mean, try and make a 10-minute YouTube video and see if people will watch it the whole way through, let alone 98 minutes. So,
attention's not getting any better.
Yeah, I quickly realized that, you know, that the effort of a collaborative team is so important. And really, in the world of documentary and of what I did, it's you know, why do you care? You know, honestly. Why do I care? I as in the viewer. Why do I care? Why do I want to spend an hour and a half of my valuable time watching this? You know, why do I care? And I think so many people don't start from that point. And that's a big danger, because if you're going to sit down and you, just as anyone listening who's going to watch some kind of film or documentary or story, it's like, if you don't care in the first 10 minutes, you're turning it off. If you don't care, like, you got to care. And I know that I'm saying it over and over, but that whole idea of getting somebody to care, that's crucial. That's crucial to captivating their attention.
I agree. And as we have shorter attention spans, it becomes even more important that you have something compelling to grab their attention and make sure there's something of interest to them. You know, the whole what's in it for them, that's what everyone wants to know. And I think in business, it's crucial, whatever you do, to think about your audience, to think about your end user, and keep that focus, you know, in terms of whatever story you're creating. So you talked about Nike as a brand that you thought was very effective. Is there another brand, or even with Nike, why you think they're such an effective storytelling brand?
Okay, I'll try and think of another one that comes to mind.
A food brand.
I was gonna say a brand that I think is very strong, being an Australian, is say Qantas, which is our national airline.
And Qantas never crashed.
They've never had any. Well, yeah, so I'm touching wood now because I fly them all the time. No, they've never had an accident like a crash. Exactly. And they've had problems, but they never had that. So, if I take say that airline, Qantas, I mean, the fact that Australians traditionally, we're very proud people of our country. We are, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to some American friends the other night. And they were talking about the World Cup, the World Cup soccer, or as the rest of the world calls it, World Cup football. And they were really shocked. They were traveling in Europe, and they were really shocked at how the whole world stopped for these games. And I think they were in a part of the world where England and Croatia were playing in, and they just couldn't understand how all these people were supporting their country. Because that doesn't happen in America. Americans are incredibly patriotic people in terms to their flag and to, you know, the United States of America and the Pledge of Allegiance and all of this. But if you really think about it from a national sporting team, I don't know of any, and maybe you can tell me, but I don't know any where the whole country comes behind a team. They're very strong on, like, supporting the Cubs or the Yankees or the Angels or the Dallas Cowboys or the Giants.
Eagles, our Super Bowl champs, come on.
The Eagles, but that's not national. So,
right.
So Americans are great sports lovers. They love mm-hmm. their sport. They love their teams, and they love getting together with their friends. And but on a national level, it's very interesting that you have the other countries, smaller countries, not as powerful, not as big as an economic force. And so going back to Australia, you know, when Australian football or Socceroos play, basically, you know, most of the country stops. We have a cricket team, which is when you're a little kid, if you play in the Australian cricket team, it's like every little boy's dream. We have the Hockeroos, you know, we have all of these national teams. And so for us to have a national airline, I mean, I can't imagine Americans getting excited about United or American or Southwest, right? But Aussies are generally proud of Qantas because it has this big kangaroo. It sort of goes all over the world, and we're a small country population-wise. I think we're at 25 million people now, so there's only one Aussie for every 15 Americans. And so we feel that on a world stage, we're sort of the battler, we're coming. And I think Qantas does a very good job of sort of, you know, being this international player, that it's a high standard, high service. The storytelling on Qantas now of it makes you sort of very proud of your country. The videos they show when they're talking about the seatbelt buckle up and the security. If you were to go online and YouTube what Qantas does and how they do their in-flight, you know, safety video, which is you'll like, go, oh, that's really cool, you know, like buckle up is on a swing over a, you know, and they take lots of bits of Australia and put this together, and so it's very cool. So I think that they've done a great job as a brand of telling a story that you can be, you know, you can go away and you can set free, you can travel, you can see the world. And I think that's something that, that you know, from an Australian's perspective, that they do a great job.
Well, I've flown Qantas and they do a great job. I can also say, I'm a dual citizen, so I was, and my wife is British, so we were very intrigued by, and, you know, my in-laws and everyone who's in England about the World Cup, in spite of the fact that most other people in America weren't, although I think a part of that is the fact that America wasn't in it. The United States didn't have a team. You know, we didn't make it.
Yeah, but you did have a team, I think it was the one before last or the last one, and they did quite well. And I remember, I remember a lot of Americans got excited, but
it's not the same.
I'm talking about the whole country.
Yeah. We're much more regional that way, you know.
Well, you've got 330 million people. That's hard to get everyone excited. But I will say India, they all get behind the cricket team in India, and there's 1.3 billion of them. So it's something that's just an interesting – it's not good, it's not bad, it's just interesting.
It's different, yes. I agree. Because as patriarchs as we are, we don't have the same. It's interesting. We call things, you know, the World Championship, the World Series. You know,
Japan and America play baseball, and it's the World Series, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Without getting that down that rabbit hole, so I think it's important that we try and support those things that are important to us, and I think that's something that whether it's juicing or your team is a theme that you, clearly you're passionate about what you do, and I think that's an important lesson for us all to learn. I'm going to ask you now, Joe, if you could share a story, and I leave this fairly loose, you know, where you or someone you know kind of connected the dots. So if you could share a story with us, I would love to hear it.
Sure. So you know, in terms of this idea of connecting the dots, and I think it's a really it's a really interesting concept, Jeffy, so I commend you on that. And I think that for me, I would go back to you know, when I was on this journey that I've been on now for, you know, I've been on it for 12 years. I'm 52 now, and I was 40 when I sort of woke up on my 40th birthday after having a monster night out with my buddies and drinking and eating a whole bunch of crap and smoking a couple of packets of cigarettes and, you know, what you do to celebrate. And, you know, I was I was not a healthy boy. I was 330 pounds on the scales. I was pre-diabetic. I was at high cholesterol, high blood pressure. I was taking pills every morning and every night for a debilitating autoimmune disease that I'd had for 8 long years. And essentially, you know, when I looked in the mirror that morning, I was fat, I was sick, and I was nearly dead. And that's where that title for my first film really came from, having that conversation with myself, what I call getting into the house of mirrors and having a good hard look at yourself and being very honest and very truthful. And, you know, truth and honesty is something that is very difficult to have with yourself. It's like, you know, sometimes it's very easy to be truthful and honest to other people, sometimes, okay? But it can be very difficult to put the lens on yourself and be very exposed and very honest and very transparent. And that's what I actually did on this particular morning of my 40th birthday. So it began a journey of me trying to see if it was possible that I could not be fat, sick, and nearly dead. That if there was a way that I could take, you know, what path did I take, or where did I go wrong? What, because this wasn't in the brochure of what I set out to do. You know, when I left high school, I didn't sort of say, you know what, on my 40th birthday, I want to have the list of all these things, and you know, I want to be chronically ill. I want to look like I'm 70. I want to, you know, this wasn't something, I didn't tick the box and order that for room service, you know. But so I started to take a very interest, I took a large sort of interest in my life and where I had been and where the journey I had traveled and where I was to now. And very quickly, I realized that it wasn't just about me, but it was about the fellow travelers around me on this planet. And I started to then even think it was not only just about us today that's alive today. We have to go back to our forebears, our ancestors that were here before us. And so all of a sudden, very quickly, I went from this microcosm of my little unimportant life, if you want to put it in that perspective, to this greater story of humanity. And I used that greater story of humanity to really define my own journey, because I feel that the bigger the lens, the bigger the more subject matter, the bigger the sample size, I guess, the more accurate you can be in terms of making decisions. Because if we look at things through our own lens of our own of our own self, it's more difficult. So I wanted to get the large sample size of maybe all the humans that ever lived. What did they do?
That's a fairly big sample size.
And how do we become this most successful species on the planet? Because there's not a lot of things we know, but I can tell you right now what we do, what I know, is that we're number one on the planet right now. I mean, there's, you know, we are the main predator. We are the top of the food chain, okay? And, you know, we're the only species on this planet that's ever been able to affect the biosphere and to do as much good and as much harm that we are doing. So how did this happen? How did we get here? And what was it along the way that was critical, that was mission critical to that success? So that's kind of where I started. And pretty soon and pretty quickly, and by the way, this whole journey I'm talking about took me about 6 to 9 months of really devoting a lot of effort and energy and time and research and listening, a lot of listening to get there. It just didn't all happen in front of the mirror on that morning of my birthday. Just to be
that would
clear.
Be a lot for one day.
so this was like this. It starts with who was here first, and before us. And this is in the Adam and Eve. If you believe in creationism, which I accept that you know, I think it's about 15% of Americans believe in creationism, which is Adam and Eve story, and that Earth is 6,000 years old. I don't subscribe to that. I subscribe more to evolution, but I'm respectful of everybody's opinion. And even if you go with Adam and Eve versus evolution, the plants were here first, okay? Plants were here first in both stories. And so we came after plants. And if you think about this incredible romance, this love affair, this nurturing effect that plants have had on humanity's life, they've done so much for us. They've provided shelter from the elements. You know, you cut down trees, you can build a log house. In the wintertime, you can put a log on a fire and it'll burn for quite some time. And so they provide heat. In the evenings, they take this incredible dance of breath. You know, we breathe out CO2. They take the CO2 in and give us back O2, and we breathe that in. And so there's this connection of breath between plants. They also do a phenomenal job, which we all know of this thing, photosynthesis, of taking these energy elements, be it the sun, be it the minerals in the soil, be it from the atmosphere, be it the molecules of hydrogen and oxygen that fall from the sky to create H2O, to magically, and it is magic, Mother Nature at her finest, producing all these incredible colorful arrays of plants that are edible for us, from fruits to vegetables to nuts to beans to seeds to some grains. It's really quite it's a magical story of just how mission critical plants play in our existence, livelihood, and success. And so when you have that macro picture, and when you join all those dots together and just see how imperative plants were in our happiness, in our success, in our life, and then I zoom into Joe's life at 40, and I realized that when I left home and I said goodbye to mum and dad, and you know, I had my own freedom to put my own pay packet to use at the local Chinese and local Thai and local hamburger joint and local pizza joint. And, you know, I'd have the 50,000 flavors of the world every week in my takeaway kitchen. I realized that I, in effect, turned my back on Mother Nature, that I effectively flicked Mother Nature the bird when I was 18 and said, you know what? I know you've been here for all these other humans, but I'm special. I'm different. Now, I'm going to defy the laws of the biological laws of cause and effect. It ain't going to happen to me. I'm just going to go and eat all this crap. I'm not going to eat your food. I'm going to go and eat this new kid on the block, which is called processed food, which has been around maybe 75 years. And I'm not. I just, you know, the closest I'm going to come to Mother Nature will be the pickles on my Big Mac. So, I having understood this bigger story, the bigger reference of just how critical plants were, and then to see myself in my own image of, you know, basically for 22 years not embracing Mother Nature in that way, and not having that perspective, it was no wonder that I was where I was. It was no wonder that I had been taking pills for 8 years. It's no wonder that I was, the chemistry in my body was at breaking point, and that I had a disease of inflammation. And so it became quite apparent that I really needed to go back and knock on Mother Nature's door and say, hey, remember me? And unlike plenty of other people in my life I've disappointed, Mother Nature actually opened the door and said, g'day, Joe, you look a bit different. I haven't seen you in a long time. And Mother Nature was very, you know, very happy to hear that I wanted to do something. But as she said to me, she said, Joe, you know, talk sheep, it's all about action. You know, words ain't going to help you. You got to put the effort in. And so there began my journey of basically learning how to embrace, to get connected with, to fall in love with, to cherish the world of plants and to honor and respect them. And coming at it from that perspective versus coming at it from perspective of someone telling you to eat your greens, very different. Because the dots lined up and the stars aligned internally for me, that this made sense. And because I did the work on it, because it came from within, because I already knew this, it's like I go back to, you don't learn anything new, you remember what you've forgotten. We're born with this. Every human is born with this innate desire to eat or to get thirsty or to breathe. And we see in color predominantly because fruits and vegetables are colorful. I mean, a third of our brain is taken up with this idea of color and vision. If you look at all the animals in the world that see in black and white, they eat one thing. If you look at the omnivores, the things that eat multiple things, they see in color. So we have this beautiful images of the light reflecting off these molecular structures. And when we see green, of course, that's the one that's been reflected. Everything else has been absorbed. And that molecular structure of a cucumber is different to, say, a beet, and it's different to an orange bell pepper, and it's different to, you know, a purple carrot. The micronutrients, the enzymes, the vitamins, the minerals, the stored value that is inside those plants, just waiting to be utilized by our cellular structure. You know, that's an incredible story. I mean, that alone, we could spend 5 or 6 hours talking about the power of those micronutrients. You know, we're very good at getting the macronutrients, the fat, the protein, the carbohydrate. We're world champions at that. But to get those micronutrients, they're only really found, you know, predominantly in plant food. And if the average American, the average Aussie, the average Brit is consuming, out of every 20 calories, only one of those calories has this micronutrient value and 19 have the macronutrient values, then is there any wonder that we are living in a time where it's an epidemic of chronic disease and pain and suffering and misery? And so to me, it's not so much about, you know, breaking people and telling people that they're no good and they're losers and they're hopeless. I really feel that the power of story is the answer here, that if just 10 people listening to this story that I tell go on that journey themselves to discover that connection between plants and themselves, I tell you, you'll look at plants a different way when you go to a supermarket for the rest of your life. It'll be revealed. And so to me, I then made this intention of I'm going to live on plants alone. I'm going to live on them. And so I made this, you know, sort of bet with myself, this agreement that, right, I've done 22 years of, you know, basically telling Mother Nature to jump in the lake. What if I did 2 years of just eating her stuff, okay? I love my bread and cake and ice cream, and I love my burgers and so on. So I'm not going to do it for the rest of my life, because that is a goal. That's something that's too much. Let's worry about the rest of my life later. Let's worry about it. Period of time where I've done a crime and now I've got to do the time, and let's make it measurable. So I felt that 2 years was a good enough penalty to be sort of in the penalty box of just, you know, having fruit and vegetables. I called it the fruit and veggie prison, where that's all I'm going to consume. So this was the idea of how I was going to fix the sick part. Now the fat part, then logic started to work, is that why do we get fat? I mean, what's the reason that we all put on, you know, 20, 30, 40 pounds when all we want to do is sit down, watch sport, eat pizza and drink soda. I mean, that's fun stuff. Why is that so bad for us? Well, turns out that the way evolution works is that keeping energy stored on our body was a key to our success. It was really important because sometimes there was feast, but a lot of the time there was famine. So we've created this economic world of supply chain where there is no famine anymore. It's just all feast. So what you're doing now in your 5 days of juice is you're imposing sort of a semi. You're still getting, you're having a feast of micronutrients, but you're really putting an imposed famine on those macros in a big way. And so I kind of realized pretty quickly that I needed to utilize a lot of the energy that was on my body that was just protecting me and waiting for the next famine to hit Sydney or LA or New York. But yeah, it wasn't coming. So unless I did something about it myself, I was just going to be carrying around all this extra energy. So the idea of the fasting was, well, I don't think I should just do water because I've just laid out a great story as to why plants are so important. And then it dawned on me that most of these plants are made up of water, and that's the water is within the plant. So what if for this 2 year period, what if for the first 2 months, what if for the first 60 days, I decided to just drink the water from plants? What if that was my sort of entry into the world of this 2 year prison sentence, kind of like solitary confinement for the first 2 months, if you like, then I'll be in the general public. So this idea was sort of took 6 to 9 months, and it was the answer to my observation of myself being fat, sick, and nearly dead. I thought if I could take care of the fat and take care of the sick, the nearly dead would take care of itself. And so my journey began. The idea of putting a camera on myself and making a story about it came very late. It wasn't the main reason. That was very late in the piece. I did 60 days of juice, and then I still was on my meds. I wasn't completely cured, but just 3 more months of eating fruits, vegetables, nuts, beans, and seeds, I was off all meds. My chemistry was like rock star. My bloods, my numbers were perfect. I'd lost over 100 pounds or just on 100 pounds. And I was able to then sort of get out of jail card free. I didn't have to do the 2 years. I started to introduce other foods very carefully. So what was originally a 2 year sentence ended up only being 5 months. And there were certain foods that I took a long time to bring in, and there are certain foods, you know, 12 years later or 11 years later, I should say, I have never brought back in. You know, I've never had Coca-Cola. I have never had alcohol. I've never had cigarettes. I've never had fast food, you know, from a fast food chain, big chain fast food restaurant. There are certain rules that I just don't go there because I figure, why would I? I mean, you know, that doesn't mean that Coca-Cola is a bad thing, by the way, because if you're someone, Jeffrey, who can have a can of Coke once every 2 weeks after a game of golf, I say, well done, mate, but I don't think I can because that was something that was so part of my life where I was drinking so much of it that I'd be very worried that it would slip back to being, well, I had one now, what about another one? What? And all of a sudden it's a slippery slope. So I've recognized it personally. I just don't want to go there and open up that genie bottle. So I guess that if I, in summation, to me, the joining of the dots, the way that I told a story to myself, which was a story that ended up being amplified by my film, but it was a story of saving my own life, really, is what we're talking about. And while other people had told me what to do and other people had, you know, always been saying, you know, you need to lose a few pounds, you need to eat better, you need to do all of those things, that's water for duck's back. I mean, this idea of telling people what to do ain't going to work. If everybody did what they were told, we wouldn't need law enforcement. Okay, so it's just an unrealistic thing to think that laws and that, you know, people can stand up and tell people what to do. That's just not going to happen. So it has to come through storytelling, and I believe the best sort of storytelling is when you are someone who can give enough little tidbits of information. It's told in a non-threatening way. It's told in a personal way. It's told in an authentic way. And that enables others to take some of that and use it for themselves. Because the story I just told, this is not just my story. This is the story of humanity, which is why I started so big. So it's everybody's story. And therefore, it's whether you choose to adopt it or not, well, that's up to you.
I almost want to say amen. You know, I'm not a religious person, but I felt like you just were preaching there. So thank you. I think, again, especially in that end part about, you know, those little elements about being authentic and the power of story and how you have to kind of share your story rather than imposing what you believe on someone and then for them to take the bits that make sense and resonate with them. And I think that's why your film has been so successful, is because the authentic and personal way that you've shared it has resonated with people who are going through similar things of varying degrees, and they can all see, you know, making it relatable is really important. I think that's where you were really successful in telling that story to be relatable to so many people. Joe, this has been awesome, and, you know, it's been great, and I think a lot of people listening will be able to understand not only how storytelling can be improved, but again, you know, the continuation of your journey. I will also include, you know, the website and all your other social things so people can follow you as you continue to spread the gospel of plants. I think I might call this the Gospel of Plants. Maybe that'll be the title for this.
I appreciate it. Yeah, it's nice to get a chance to talk about story, because a lot of podcasts I go on, they don't really focus on the storytelling side. They're very interested in facts, and facts are facts. But, you know, stories, well, I think they're the answer. They're the secret. You know, we've been doing it. We've been telling stories for as long as we've been here, and if there's one thing I know that's going to keep going is the art of storytelling. It'll be keeping going long after you and I aren't here anymore.
Agree completely. Joe, good luck with your travels. I know you're abroad at the moment, and thank you for your inspiration to me personally, and thank you for coming on this podcast and sharing your thoughts on story and your story itself. And also, I just want to say thank you for helping us connect the dots.
Thanks, Jeffrey. It's been great. Enjoy your reboot, mate. Keep up the great work.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode and found it of value. I would super appreciate if you would subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It would be amazing if you could leave a review, comment, and share. Share and show you care. Check out 9Dots Podcast for more great episodes. Remember, story matters. Thanks again for helping me connect the dots.